Welcome to the Practice Podcast, conversations probing the nature of practice. I'm your host, Dave Fearon, co-author with Peter Vail of the digital book on Practice as a Way of Being. Find it at mylibrary.world. And now to our show. This is another episode of conversation with my son Dave about social inaction within which practice occurs, within which information happens. So that's about as simply as I can put what we're going to talk about, what Dave's going to talk about, and I'm going to listen and learn. Information itself, a word that we throw around as if we understand everything about it. And when you get through this episode, you'll know more about it, but you'll realize that we're only beginning to understand the importance of information to us as living beings and how it keeps us going. And we keep information flowing. So here then is my son, Dave Fearon, and his dad. Well, welcome back to another conversation, father to son. Son being the instructor here, and father being the learner. I don't know if Dave even knows this, but back in 1985, I was a visiting professor at Colby College, where Dave attended several years later. And they asked me to create a course about the onset of information technology. Now, in 1985, that was a research question. So I remember constructing the course around one word, information. And I said, for the whole semester, we're going to explore not only what information was and why it arrived here in 85 is something we all think we know about, take it for granted, but we're going to start projecting into the future what could happen if computers, which we did have back then, not PCs, we had a mainframe, if computers, which provide us what turns into information, were to take over the world. I didn't know about AI, but yes, they've taken over the world. But with a few of us humans left who haven't been taken over by AI, let's have a conversation, Dave, about information. And what does it have to do with practice and particularly social inaction?
Well, I think I'll be talking a little bit about the periphery of practice. Well, no, I won't be talking about the periphery of practice. What I want to do with how the different talks we've had so far have been treating the concept of social inaction, which I think I've been embedding in a lot of different updated, both early and updated theories on various aspects of both social interaction and its context, right down to physics in some cases. I think a little tour through both a little bit of what we've been talking about so far and some new things, the latest things I've been reading, can use the theme of information to kind of carry us through what is meant. And one of the main themes I want to get across is that information is not necessarily abstract. And beyond that, we can even say it's physical. Information has, and maybe entirely and always, a physical base. And when it comes to human beings, a base is in what people actually do. And this is one aspect of what we call practice.
We do. That's
people
right.
Doing things, but also coming from a broader context that seems abstract, but when you really look at how people do things, it's not necessarily as abstract as that. And I'm going to try, see how we can how far we can get, but possibly take this right down into physics. Like, is there really a basis, not only in physical basis for information, but following laws of physics to some degree? We might even touch on quantum theory again and things like that, or we'll see how we do.
Let's rock it out.
As we say in Maryland, we put our toes in the water. But
oh my Lord, he's going Maryland on me.
But you know, I think where you started in 1985 is good, because it is a nice segue about where a lot of information theory was then, and certainly had a history before then, but largely around the dawn of computing. Mm-hmm. And certainly that's become kind of one of the big vernaculars of thinking about it. And it's also one where it's very easy to think of information in the abstract, given the notion of the internet and the cloud, and we don't really think of electronic bits. We don't think of, you know, the big data centers that are supplying our phones. We just kind of ask questions into the air and our phones give us the answer. One of the themes around information in a sense is how is information like a computation? You know, starting with the early days of computing and not going too deep into it, you know, some of the big early names that kind of led to this type of information theory was Alan Turing.
Turing, yeah.
Who based his work, I believe, largely on the great physicist von Neumann, who was kind of had the early mathematical models of how to turn, you know, the more the abstract world of information into something that could be computed and broken down into little steps and stages of processes and even programming. And Turing did this during World War II. He was famous for creating the Enigma, cracking the Enigma machine. You saw that movie several years ago, following that along, coming up with the mechanical means of a computing device that could decrypt the German messages. And that kind of led to other basic notions of computing and computation. But even then, it was sort of using the idea of messages in the abstract being worked upon, passed along, stored. Another big stage after Turing that's famous, I think, really started defining information theory as a theory was Claude Shannon.
Yeah.
And those of you in the business world probably hear come across that name, but it's pretty general. He really did some foundational ideas of how to define information as computation. But as an engineer, he was doing it out of his work during World War II, but then later on in the Bell Labs, working on the problems of sending messages over wires and other forms of communicating based on the problems of the physical medium, whether it be telephones, telegraphs, or over the air, where you have a physical medium that has limits to the bandwidth or whatever it is you're transmitting. So you can only get so much information over a telephone line. And how do you, apart from, you know, analog voice, how do you get even more information on there, but also correct for the errors or kind of the entropy that comes up as you're communicating. So he did a lot of things that solved, as an engineering problem, the most efficient ways to pass messages along a channel with limited bandwidth. And this is done by ignoring what might not be needed within the message and focusing on what would be useful to the recipient. So there's a sense of the transaction from the encoding of the message to its transmission to its interpretation for some observer who needs to understand it. And then also this definition of relevance, what's relevant within the message. And you can kind of compute that given the type of message, where you can break down, I think he came up with ways to break down messages like repeating words might not necessarily, or parts of words might not need to be duplicated. Basically, he I believe coined the word bits as a way of his colleagues came up with the word bits, of breaking it all down to the yes and no, is this one of these or not one of these, which becomes, you know, the ones and zeros of binary code. And that became the most efficient way to break information into the basic message that could then be matched against the errors. So there's kind of a stochastic, or a statistical measure of uncertainty, which is becomes kind of part of the definition of information. How much uncertainty is there in order to confirm the message? You can also kind of think of knowledge in a sense as this being able to store this information, focusing on this potential to be reenacted or repeated. He even kind of brought in early use of, we've talked about Markov, the Markov formulas of statistics in the past, and I'm going to bring them up again.
The blanket. Later,
where here was there's something called the Markov chain statistics, where basically given state one, there's a probability of certain next states, and that next state depends on the conditions of the prior state. So you have this kind of communication of one state to another, again with this measure of uncertainty or entropy. So it kind of gives a nice, both a conceptual and practical definition of information, this method of reducing details into their essential parts is the basis of compression. It's the basis of, you know, taking your music file and turning it into as small a file as possible.
I do that with the podcast recordings. I do a compression.
Yeah, I mean, the whole internet now relies on that. So now you can have a real high definition movie taking, you know, fairly small, relatively small amount of information, space, storage space, ones and zeros. But in doing so, it kind of gives you this notion of all information being abstract in this sense. And almost, you know, you can almost think of it as this disembodied level of information, given that we can effectively ignore all these ones and zeros in what we do with information, which we need to do in all other aspects of life, such as language. We don't think of every syllable. We don't have to process, in a way that we're aware of all the details of language. But information kind of became defined in this abstract way, and also in this computational way, the notion that there has to be kind of preset rules, that the rules are what determine the next state, and you're kind of following in order to understand information, you're really kind of uncovering the abstract rules, and it tends to make you lose track of the actual physical exchange, what's actually involved, what matters. And I think where in various ways the notion has influenced early ideas at the time of neuroscience and cognitive science and even sociology and other fields that kind of liked this abstract rule-based notion of how people interact and how they think. Certainly earlier was the whole stimulus response idea of causality. But what we've been talking about with an action is something that's dealing more with the embodied world, the actual process of putting together words or information, carrying it through, and also its messiness, its complexity, and really being able to deal with that complexity, not simply ignore it, but figure out, oh, how do we, or how does any entity unpack the complexity and come up with relevance and keep make something into information in an actual exchange of information.
I think it's a miracle that it happens.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is the miracle part of it, as I keep looking and seeing, especially in the last 10 or 15 years, what's been discovered, it's not as mysterious a miracle as it seems.
Oh.
Because when you really look into all the parts, it's certainly complex. And it is a whole science of complexity that best expresses what's going on. But I don't know, I think over our talks, we've unpacked a lot of it, from the brain to language to maybe beyond, and into the quantum level, to something, you know, physical level. I'm going to get more into that. I guess some broad steps of the evolution of where we're coming from now with an action is to see what came after Shannon. One of the kind of middle steps you could think of was Gregory Bates, and was a kind of a broad thinker. I didn't look up his field of research. I believe he was kind of a generalist.
Was one of the ones didn't he come up with a cyber notion?
Yeah, he did focus on the cyber.
And
certainly is known for that, which, you know, other people's work, but he kind of was a good thinker and applier of that. And he, in relation to information, his famous quote is that information is the difference that makes a difference. So it's kind of capturing relevance, but it's also kind of capturing the different points of view of the, you know, the communicators of information as they go, so that, you know, that it's a difference to an some organism or entity that can define that which occurred as information, as being somehow relevant to what happens next. And you know, as we get into humans, what we might call meaningful. So, and also with this notion of cybernetics, being a systems response to information as something encountered, or information as something they produce and deliver out to others in this communication sense, there's this internal cybernetic, what he called a kind of a cybernetic feedback process of perceiving information and responding by adapting both its external structure in order to show something externally, that, by the way, in how information might matter. And this would be in communication. I hear something, I'm interpreting it internally, but I'm also doing something in response. And if it's a conversation, that response is something that I would expect you to understand, to keep the conversation going.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a nice addition to getting more in touch with what was taken away from early information theory and putting it back into something that's more embodied, something that's more about what organisms do, people do, any living beings might do. Taking it to the next step, where I would say it became the foundations of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about inaction, social inaction, and inaction more generally as a way of defining information. I talked in an earlier episode, I don't have the episode number in front of me, but we talked about an important step in systems theory was the work of Ilya Prigogine. Mm-hmm. In the mostly in the 70s and 80s, where he talked about self-organizing systems, what happens when a system of any variety of sorts, including even certain chemical reactions, gets far from its equilibrium state, kind of at the edge of what might be called chaos, where a thing might collapse into little bits, or just kind of slow down into stopping and kind of as at an equilibrium state. If you go somewhere in that sweet spot, you start to get very interesting, complex organizations that have a lot to do with feedback, self-feedback. You know, those are some broad lines, but when you get to something that's clearly a living system, you can find ways to define that, those particular sorts of networks in a way that gives us an interesting way into defining information, building upon what Bateson added. At least for me, and I think for the field in general, a big step was the development of autopoiesis theory. This was around the late 70s and 80s, two Chilean biologists, I think one was did a lot of work in neuroscience. Autopoiesis, auto as in car, and poiesis. It's a Greek term. It means roughly producing oneself. The two researchers are Francisco Varela, Varela, and Umberto Maturana. And I think Francisco Varela was especially got into the depths of the both kind of the math and the concepts that underlie the idea. So the general notion is that living systems, a cell, has a bounded structure, it has a boundary within which it exists. So a cell certainly has a membrane. Without the cell's membrane, it falls apart, doesn't live. But the membrane is porous. The membrane can let in certain required substances and keep out others. So it has to interact with its world or environment in such a way that it can filter, kind of have a sense of what is belongs to it and what doesn't, what has a capacity to sustain it or destroy it. And this is the characteristic of the of its interaction with the world. So as it takes something in, there has to be some way of knowing what it can do with it, especially to rebuild itself. So in addition to being able to filter what comes in itself, there's also part of its actions are actually rebuilding the very cell or system by which it exists. But once it takes something in and removes what's useful from it, it can't leave it inside the system or it will accumulate as waste. You could think of as type of entropy. So it has to export the waste outside that boundary. So those are, you know, so there's an essential aspect of self-sustaining, self-organization through an interaction with a world that the organism itself defines by what's relevant. So there's kind of an embodied definition of what an environment is for that particular autopoietic system. And there's also kind of, you could kind of think of this as an identity function, like, you know, this, there is something outside of me that is either relevant to me, harmful to me, or irrelevant to me. And once it's in me, is it part of me? Am I is it for reproducing myself as a system, or not? And there's also another aspect of it is Varela and Maturana kind of considered this as a sort of a cognitive, a very rudimentary for something like a cell, a cognitive process by being able to define and segregate a world into what's relevant and what isn't, defined by what sustains itself, which they called operational closure. The mm-hmm. idea of closure is that there are operations or are interactions. If it's closed, comes back on itself, the that particular system has adapted and survived. If it's destructive to its especially its boundary or other components, then it doesn't have operational closure. So it's a very much an empirical question at any moment whether operational closure is achieved. So how does this relate to information? I would say this is one of what they thought of as information was physical. And I think that applies even to more broad sense, because one aspect of this operational closure is that it can define the whole from the point of view of an observer would seem abstract. So, you know, in an abstract sense, we can see the cell as a whole, but the cell itself, you know, doesn't necessarily have have any real sense or that matters, that it is itself a whole. It is just the achievement of those parts. So in other words, there's a sense in which the cell or any other operationally closed system is following an overall pattern, but it's the pattern for an observer. And yet there is this sort of global sense of a whole that emerges from the interaction of these parts. So the pattern doesn't really exist doesn't exist in a magical abstract sense for some magical observer. It exists for that particular interaction, what they call kind of a structural coupling of the system with its world or with another system. So if you had two bacteria interacting, each one is in a sense an observer of the other, because one is acting as a whole, as though the other were a complete whole, the pattern of their, you know, self-organization, not so much, you know, the internal parts of the other bacterium doesn't really matter, unless one's consuming the other and they break it into pieces and then they use those pieces. Yeah. So I guess where we're going then with information is, where is there a way to define information in this way? I'm arguing that information has this physical sense, this physical embodiment, where relevance becomes defined by the adjustment of a operationally closed system to what it encounters, and that they kind of go into thinking of this structural coupling as a form of communicating information. Each part is making its own distinction, but also kind of in that adjustment, giving a sense of a pattern that the other could adjust to and make relevant. And so you don't necessarily have to have two things touching each other, but, you know, quickly organisms evolved to be able to adjust to other things at a distance using perception, using, you know, light, sound, motion, anything that could be emitted from another organism and the rest of the world in order to act upon other living and non-living things from a distance. And so this is kind of a different level of information transfer that, you know, scale it up and becomes communication among animals, communication within our brains, among parts of our brains. You know, sort of level upon level of these emergent observer like functions, but that are actually always this kind of levels of that come down to these physical moments of autopoiesis, even within the brain or other systems. So you know, there are lots of these relations. We talked about the left and right hemispheres of the brain as each being kind of observers of the other, adjusted to each other. And then Bhatarana defined languaging as this process of making distinctions of distinctions. So you know, at the first level, you're encountering the world, making a distinction of what's relevant from what isn't. Language is kind of adding another level of that. You're making first level distinctions of your cognitive perceptions into a symbolic perception as a second level distinction that another person, a human, can then act upon as a distinction that can then break down into the lots of little parts that the rest of the brain can make sense of. So you know, it's complicated, but I think I like being able to take the notion of information and put it somewhere that's ultimately physical in this sense. So I worked with I spent a lot of time while I was working on my dissertation trying to do a nice grounded autopoiesis approach to conversation and interaction, which hadn't really been done in quite, you know, the ways I'd in previous broadcasts I talked about conversation analysis and how to really look closely at talking itself. But it was challenging. I went down a rabbit hole, and then at one point, I won't get too much into it, but an organization researcher, Ralph Stacey, in England, he had this critique of autopoiesis that at the time made so much sense to me, I abandoned it entirely. His critique, and roughly, was that it seemed the way they modeled it, they required the future states to be somehow embedded within the organization itself. And then he also had another complaint that it kind of relied too much on everything being a system, where the real world is some things are systems and some things are not. They're just kind of a resonance. Yes, there's the book right there.
Complex Responsive Processes in Organizations, Learning and Knowledge Creation.
Yeah, it's a valid critique, and it's a great extension. Maybe we'll get into it some other time, because the extension is that not everything is really kind of this structurally coupled to real living, you know, defined living systems with boundaries bumping into each other. There's also kind of a resonance that doesn't need the whole system, but that still is interacting in complex ways and is best described by complexity. But you can kind of expand away from the need to always define living things in order to understand the world. And I think what it does, it lets you like say, okay, how is an interaction with a cell phone also kind of following these dynamics? And maybe language, like the way we talked about it, isn't it itself a living thing? Language, like the course of talk, it almost seems organized enough as though you call it abstractly its own living thing, but it isn't. It's more like this resonance complex resonance between two people who are living things. So
I like that better.
Yeah. Just kind of then briefly the next step, and I did another episode on but at least resolve the problem of autopoiesis always requiring a future state. It's actually, I think Carl Friston's work on neuroscience and computational processes of the brain and neuronal groups, he brought in the concept of the Markov blanket, and also predictive processing, which gave a better notion of how to think of a system representing its world that the autopoiesis people always complained against. They had a really strict notion that there is no representation of the world. There's no internal modeling. You can't open someone's head and find a model, because everything is so deeply embedded in these moments of structural coupling that there's no unity, sense there. But I think, not getting too deep into the weeds, but the idea of a Markov blanket is that you have lots of things, lots of complex systems within any given, unit that you're looking at, let's say someone's brain, lots and lots of complex things, but those are all kind of children relationships with an overall parent relationship that's kind of a surface. So you could kind of think of a cell that way. The surface is its membrane. Inside, there's lots and lots of complex child-child relationships that you couldn't even describe if you needed to, but at least what you get then is an overall adjustment of the whole thing based on the sustaining of its parts, and then you can have various wholes interacting with each other. I'll probably do get back into another podcast on the implications of predictive processing and relevance categorization and things that. But it's just another way of I think getting some better details into information and how a network, a living system sort, handles information, defines information in that way. That kind of takes us back. If you add to that, the idea of emergent levels of organization where, given two Markov blanket interacting things or this, resonance idea, you can have parts and wholes interacting with the next level of wholes. So you go from cells to neurons to neuronal group patterns to left and right hemispheres, to brains, to language, to self and society. All those things have these levels of each working with information in its own kind of self-defined way, but all of that mattering for these different interacting, the stack of emergence that gives us the complexity of the world that we live in. We had a couple of episodes on pragmatist philosopher George Herbert Mead and how that, he tied in, almost 100 years ago, a number of those different levels from acts to basic cognition to language, self as an object in society. But still so much of it comes down to these dynamics of talk and interaction. And that I think is where you don't have to be too abstract about information when so much of it is done through talk. And that's kind of that social and action level that I'm trying to get at. What is it that's, one of the last episodes we did was on the nature of time. What's
time,
the presence, what at the present, what is it possible to perform? or based on what you might know now, in a sense, what's relevant, what's warranted and accountable, and what could be done at the moment, and in adjusting to the world, bringing forth a domain of action of which we're aware of as conscious beings, and have to sustain that consciousness through the actions themselves. That's all involving this information exchange in the way we've been talking about. But I was also kind of sustaining what's preserved of that information that we might call knowledge.
Yeah, I was going to say, at some point, knowledge factors into the equation.
Yeah.
But, you know, we make this assumption about knowledge. First, we assume it's different than information. I don't know about that. But what I do know is we assume that once... that knowledge is something we can have.
Mm-hmm.
I have knowledge of how to make water boil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know we could take us off into a huge tangent here, but what do I really have when I tell you that I have knowledge of how to make water boil?
Yeah, you could say it's a potential to do it again, but what's potential in what sense? It's there somehow, but you know, it's really hard to define how memory works or what it is. It hasn't been,
yeah.
I don't think it's been solved. But I think one way of expressing knowledge in the systems and kind of self-organizing systems term is that the knowledge is embedded in whatever given unit in its own existence, in the sustained existence, and its ability, you know, at any given moment to do certain things. What's the range of things it can do?
There you go.
And in an interactive thing like the, you know, setting like the brain, what can one part of the brain talk to the other that has structure, is structurally ready to provide certain sort of exchanges and adjustments that in itself would bring out, you know, the basis for then translating into the actions of boiling water. It's ineffable somewhere in the quadrillion neuronal connections.
Oh, gee.
But somehow, you know, each little part is able to find its own relevance to pull it out when, you know, make it available when needed and present it to kind of another part of the brain that treats it as an observer would, as though it were an abstract unit.
Yeah. So you have what your brain tells you is an egg, and you want that egg to be cooked. And I say, well, I know how to boil water. You know, then you'll put your egg in my water, and then you'll have a cooked egg. So in up until the second that you have an egg, I don't know that I know how to boil water, right?
And yeah.
Either I create that explanation and that action out of whatever bits around my brain. But I think we've gotten this idea that, oh, okay, I file over here my egg boiling knowledge.
Right.
It sits over here like in an archive.
Yeah. But is there an it that's quite there? Well, it's kind of been divided into lots of little bits that,
yeah,
it's hard to even say they're there, but they can reorganize.
Yes. See, that's the part that I remember you explaining about autopoiesis, is that fact that it can reorganize in an unmeasurable second. I mean, it's just suddenly it, and that's how we can sustain talk, isn't it? That I don't know what you're going to say next, and then you say it, and then my brain comes up with a response based on the information that's there.
Yeah, but to you know, extreme details, ones that you when you look closely at talk, we looked a little bit two episodes ago, you know, these things like when we were talking about these diagraphs where it's like the way that two people match their words to the other, even something as simple as using the rising tone of a question mark, using exactly the same words that someone used before. It's a thing. It's doing something. It's like an operator. It's almost like a computer program in the sense that doing this now is something we've learned as an agreement to alter, both alter our states in a particular way that's predictable for each of us. And yet never could we, while we're doing it, pull it apart into those conditions. You know, every now and then we can say, oh, I'm going to ask a question. But the actual asking the question is something that is like driving a car. You don't have to think about it. And there's lots and lots of little things that we do with amazing ordination that do things. They do things. Kind of the next step, we'll see how far we get, whether it needs to be another part or not. But I wanted to kind of blast through what I've been obsessed with, getting into some areas of physics. It kind of comes up. It's interesting in physics. Physicists are kind of slowly getting into complexity. Although I believe it was Stephen Hawking says complexity is like the thing of the 21st century. Understanding complexity is a challenge for all those who have been busily figuring out how the universe works using it's a simpler place in a way, because it follows a fairly finite number of rules to get planets and stars and black holes and things to work. But, you know, getting into brains is almost incomprehensible. Well, that level of complexity, I think a number of areas of physics are trying to get into. But what I like about it is it kind of makes that connection from this abstract and magical sense that we kind of skip over when we're talking about information in the human world, to what is still physical, what has to do with physical laws, you know, like entropy or the law of conservation of energy. And so there's some work in that. I'll just kind of drop the name of one area that's kind of looking at that little threshold between what's a living system and what isn't, and how it might have evolved in the first place. It's called assembly theory. It's by Leroy Cronin, University of Glasgow, and his team. I'll just use this kind of Google. There's some interesting talks on and YouTube about it. You know, it's just one attempt to kind of get mathematically figure this out. Another one, though, that I really have been into is, finally, I have a woman to talk about, a physicist, Chiana Marletto, who's at Oxford. And she worked with David Deutsch originally to come up with something that's called constructor theory. But she kind of, from her dissertation on, she's gone a bit in her own direction, and has a wonderful book called The Science of Can and Can't.
I like that.
And I looked at some of her articles, which are mostly equations, and so yeah, whenever I see equations, I say, well, they probably know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
But at least her book for the public was pretty easy to understand, well written. She has, you know, a nice background, actually, and she likes classics and writing. So just briefly, and it's hard to kind of say in a nutshell what's special about her approach, but it is actually very revolutionary, I think. And so do other physicists, and so much of the history of physics has been around what's kind of called a classical dynamic model, where they're kind of figuring things out on the basis of there having been a big bang, or maybe there wasn't a big bang, but the big bang set certain laws in motion. The you know, the laws of the universe are such that, you know, given these mathematical expressible rules, things can build out. You'll have everything from Newtonian physics down to quantum physics, defined around you know, these basic laws of physics. She's saying, yes, there are laws of physics, but is there another way of approaching it that isn't so much about the dynamics, but about what she calls counterfactuals. Hmm. What kind of transformations of, you know, the given physical unit is possible and what isn't possible? And can you start defining things like information in terms of the physical physical things that are possible or impossible? And part of it is done through computation and thinking of the world as computation. But I think getting right quickly into what we've been talking about with living systems, where you know, a lot of physicists get excited, especially with her and who she worked with, David Deutsch, is that this is kind of their, David Deutsch in particular, came up with the theories that have led to these ideas of quantum computing. So there's a lot of excitement around that. She has interesting things to say about quantum. I don't think I'll be able to get into it, but no. Basically the idea of a counterfactual is that it's focusing on physical things that can perform tasks or transformations to some substrate of any sort. Could be, and this could be anything kind of abstractly, from a traffic light that can change from, you know, red to green to yellow, to a bacteria ingesting an organic molecule and extracting sugar, to something complex like a brain, but even down to the, you know, the quantum level of protons and electrons and things, can be kind of looked at in terms of the, what can it do? What task can it conform? But so it's like a computer program in a way, but more like what's the basis of its existence. So not so much the symbolic instruction, but what kind of, given a thing in its current states, what possible states can it transform into or act upon in relation to some substrate? Mm. So the way she defines information is to break it down into what's the basis, what's the very most basic things that it can do physically. How is information physical? Well, a thing that becomes, you know, some sort of subject that has a capacity to carry information, as she defines it, is something that can make transformations upon a given substrate that does two things. It can flip. It has at least two states, like mm-hmm. yes or no, on or off, or more than one state, which, like a living system, could probably, any given cell can do a number of things given its current makeup. So it should be able to make a certain number of transformations, and those states can be copied by another, some other entity. So there's kind of a communication sense where there's a copy operation that's possible based on the ability of one thing to interact with the states of another.
Mm.
So you can think of this in mechanical terms as if someone had a, you know, a signal light on the shore out to a boat, and they're using mm-hmm. like the semaphore. There's the on off, flip, flip, on off, yes, no, yes, no. And if the other boat is able to treat on as you know, meaningful in this sense, and also turns light on, and then that becomes a way of kind of copying that state to the other, that becomes the second part of information that has, you know, seems very abstract, but this is kind of physical basis of communication based on information in this sense. And I guess another example in living system might be something like ant communication. So and I'm kind of taking this from another guy I just ran into, a guy named Neil Thieser. I just grabbed his book on complexity. It's real nice. So you can think of ant communication. When they find food and carry it back to their lair, they leave a trail. And the trail has the ability to point to the direction of where the food came from, but also decays at a rate at which another ant can tell how long it's been since
that's amazing.
Trail was laid. So ant one carrying food will lay his trail. Ant B, so you know, the trail itself kind of is a medium that says either it's a trail or it's not a trail given its surroundings. Ant B can encounter that and know, you know, trail goes forward, not to the sides. How long has it been? It's copying both the state transformation of that first ant in a way, but also sustaining it. And so if the kind of the second ant sustains it in reverse, goes back to the source of the food, then it's copying a kind of a larger information act of transforming a thing from food, you know, not having food to having food and bringing food back. At no point are the ants really having to cognitize this, have cognition about this beyond their immediate transformations of things being information or not, you know, and they have, you know, more complex nervous systems than your traffic light, but the two lights on a boat in themselves, but it's really this physical definition of information that she says it's a way of expressing laws of physics. So there's a law in a sense, it's like a law of physics that information has these two properties and not others, and they aren't abstract. Also from this, you can kind of build an interoperable sense, so that in a sense, the trail is a medium of interaction, but the ants in a larger sense are achieving the, sustaining the interaction of food gathering. And then if you went from there into, you know, you have your ant farm, there are other layers of emergent organization that you'll see. And it's interesting, you know, the old ant farms you had as a kid. You see in the glass, they're building their little tunnels. There's interesting emergent phenomenons there where if you have around 25 ants, they'll build tunnels and they'll also build a little cemetery for their dead ants. If you had less than, you have around 10 ants, they don't build a cemetery. If you had 3 ants, they don't even do this food line thing. They just kind of wander off. So there's a sense in which
critical mass.
Yeah, it's critical mass and these emergent organizations that come up. And she also talks about, she talks a little bit about emergent organization, but a few other things she talks about is there's the idea of a catalyst, which gets into what we've been talking about with self-organization. The catalyst has this the ability to have this task or operation while preserving its own ability to act in that way again. And this could be, you know, it's clear living systems do that, but even you can look at non-living chemical systems as having this capacity. So there's a notion of sustaining something over time. What she refers to as resilience is a sustained capacity for transformations that do not destroy the catalytic action of the parts. So you get this idea of structural, you know, what we've been calling structural coupling and a bit of self-organization. And then she defines knowledge as expressing this, you know, sustained ability of using information that enables its own preservation. Enables the preservation, the capacity to use information again in a similar way.
There you go.
So, you know, but, you know, she does it in a way that with lots of math, it looked like they should be following, you know, laws of physics, essentially. And I think it would be what underlies the, you know, kind of the mathematical approach to autopoiesis or to the Markov blanket, which, you know, I has other aspects. I forgot to mention, like Friston talks a lot about information you're minimizing the randomness. Randomness information in a way is the range of possible choices that could be too much for a self-organizing system to handle unless it could minimize it down to a reasonable amount. So you could kind of express that mathematically, I think, with this constructor theory approach. And so it's all very interesting. She talks about thermodynamics. I won't get into that. She talks about quantum, which I would love to get into. I don't know if we can do it or not.
Another podcast. Remind me of her name again.
Her name is Chiara Merletto.
Chiara Merletto.
Yeah. Chiara Merletto.
Wow. And she wrote a book, one of her books, the one you quoted. Yeah.
Science of Can and Can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good book.
Sounds very good.
Yeah, so I know it's so there's lots of ways to approach information as a definition. I like the ones that are embedded in living systems, but I like that there's a way of taking it beyond living systems into smaller spaces or more broad complex things like planets and stuff like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if we can dip back into those lower levels, but I think that's enough for.
Well, you've taken us a long way today. I will not raise still other large tangential areas, but as a beginning, I was ranting the beginning of our conversation about artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So at some point going forward, given what you've helped us understand about information and right. where it, in its physical aspect. I don't know if you begin to think a lot about or a little bit about artificial intelligence, but as a lay person here in this world, I'm being bombarded with offers of applications,
Right. Right.
You can speed up your podcast, blah, blah, blah. And college professors are,
yeah,
basically struggling over what's a real paper and what's
my school, Johns Hopkins University, has just been given billions of dollars to have this massive increase in AI faculty. I mean, 100 professors or more.
I know
amount of infrastructure. Do they understand what we've been talking about?
Yeah, and my question is, since this whole phenomenon of artificial intelligence, not new, but what's new is that it's being accelerated in terms of its utilization because money can be made.
Yeah.
Lots of money can be made.
Yeah.
And so you talk about amassing a group of faculty.
Yeah.
To teach about it. What the hell do we know?
Yeah.
No, I mean, if you get a lot of curious people like you who are willing to go deep and dig it out and have interdisciplinary and cross talk and every other way to delve into artificial intelligence, we still haven't even begun to talk about morality and all other human aspects. But we can't turn our backs on it, can we?
Right. Yeah, that might be fun to go through. I don't want to actually give the secrets that will allow artificial intelligence to actually be self-aware and take over.
Yeah, but, you see, there you go. You got to hold that back. Hold
some back, but
hold it back.
But the other nice thing is, I finally, having read Chiara Merletto's book, I have a little better idea of how quantum computing works. That's kind of cool.
That might help
bring us back into that little section.
Very cool. So. Well, this has been great, Dave. I feel I've come a long way since 1985 when I asked that question. I think it's still a very enticing, open question, but it may be the question of humanity going forward. What is information to us? And it's clearly not just an adjunct to practice, but it informs practice informs it. And secondly, without talking, which is what you said a couple of times, without conversation, without people helping each other perceive something that they otherwise may not perceive. We're still very much in the footprint of where this whole series began, social inaction in practice.
So, yep.
Thank you again, Dave. This is great.
All right. Till next time.
Thank you for listening to the Practice Podcast, Conversations Probing the Nature of Practice. If you'd like to hear more, go to Podomatic, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. And please consider purchasing our book on practice as a way of being at mylibrary.world. It's a digital book with lots of features that you do not see in a conventional book. So once again, thank you, and I look forward to your listening again. Oh, and one more thing. Please check out our webpage at inactionresearch.info.